sell your stock on CKUT. And you don't know. Me nah fix it. CKUT, the number one radio station in Montreal. We give you the sun, the moon, the rain, the stars and the mountain. CKUT give you the word.
CKUT, CKUT 90.3 FM.
What is the law? What is the, 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 what is the,
Legalese, a broadcast about law cast broadly. Bienvenue à Legalese, une émission consacrée au droit qui vise à rendre les jargons plus accessibles tout en évaluant de manière critique ces institutions.
I am Camilla, I am your host for this month's edition of Legalese, and I am here today with three fellow law students, Jeanne, Anna, and Jade. We are all a part of RadLaw, the student-run collective that works to advance social justice struggles in our communities.
Hello, everyone.
Hi.
So we're here today to talk about an event we organized back in March 2022 that we named Movement Lawyering Together. During this event, we heard from seven lawyers working in different fields of law who are all contributing to the fight for social justice with their work. We heard about their career path, the challenges they face, and what keeps them inspired and energized. Just to talk about the genesis and our inspiration for this event, we thought that it was important to mention that this was inspired by some other events led by students in the US. Back in February 2020, just before the COVID-19 pandemic hit, members of RadLaw attended a conference called RevLaw, hosted by Yale. It was a three-day event featuring panels, keynote speakers, and social events. And there we heard from a range of legal practitioners working who in their work feature radical values. So we heard from BLM organizers, public defenders working to protect people from deportation in New York City, and environmental activists. We wanted to imagine something like this more locally, focusing on a context closer to us. So this is what led us to organize our own event based in SoCal, Canada, in Montreal specifically.
What we mainly wanted to achieve with this movement lawyering event was to showcase the real possibilities that the law provides to advance social justice causes meaningfully. And we wanted to do this by inviting really incredible lawyers from across Canada that inspired us with their work in their respective fields. And to us, this was really an important space to create and an important event to host at McGill Law, because it has been a common experience that a lot of us share that, you know, students arrive at law school with many aspirations that we will gain practical tools to serve our communities and, you know, help our communities for the better. And there is maybe like an idealized notion that a law degree or that a license to practice law is this incredible key that will allow one to enact fast and meaningful progressive change within an unjust social order. But at least I certainly experienced a lot of disillusion, because as we learn more about how legal systems operate, our own individual creativity can kind of be dimmed, and the law's conservative and rigid nature can take over, and it can make our imagination feel almost naive, and it is very disempowering. And you know, when we become persuaded that radical lawyering isn't attainable, we start to buy into this idea that practicing outside of the traditional path is impossible or maybe even irresponsible in some aspects. And so by hearing directly from these really rad lawyers, we wanted to highlight the variety of ways in which different folks are using their law degree in new ways to serve their communities and to reclaim what they even wanted a legal education for in the first place, right? To remind ourselves that it is possible to use a law degree to service our community. And although it's very challenging to create that path, we decide what our path is, and we can work together to make that possible.
Yeah, I really relate to feeling like with law school, even the idea of kind of a social justice path, you kind of are presented with one model a lot of the time of how that might look, or at least a few kind of more mainstream models. So I really appreciated having the space to discuss how many different ways that radical lawyering can be practiced and what that can look like. And even just being around so many different lawyers in one space, like seven lawyers all at once, was even just really encouraging to me. And to have those kinds of conversations with so many other students who were there also, or to just kind of share the space with them, was just really encouraging, I found.
Yeah, personally, I taking a step back and looking at something that I really enjoyed about this was actually just getting, you know, to hang out with some buds, some friends from Rad Law, and, you know, work on a project together that didn't have the stress of school and that felt grounded. I also, similarly to Jade, really appreciated the fact that we were able to have such different voices come together from across so-called Canada to share what their practices are like and what they envision the role of legal work to be in social justice movements. That's something I'm still working on thinking through, and I'm sure a lot of other people are as well. And as an aside, and someone who hopes to stay here, I also found it really interesting to hear what people thought about practicing in Montreal versus other cities.
So the actual event took place in March, and it was 2.5 hours in length with one panel in French and one panel in English. But for the purposes of our episode at Legalese, we will be doing this as a two-part episode. Today, we will be sharing with you highlights and clips from the English panel, and the next month, or for part two of the episode, it will be the French panel, because we just felt that the conversation was really rich, and we wanted folks to get the opportunity to hear some of these incredible reflections. So here it is. We hope you enjoy Movement Lawyering Together.
My name is Megan Daniel. I've been in practice since 2009. That's nice. And so when I came into practice, I worked for two social justice law firms in Toronto, Klippenstein's first for about a year and a half, and then Julian Faulkner's firm, Faulkner's LLP. Since about 2017, I've been on my own, although by on my own, I mean perpetually with a child on my hip, it feels like. In my own practice, and then also practicing with other firms, sharing files that are exciting. I'm also teaching at McGill on state accountability and legal strategy. And in the past, I guess most relevant, I've been a member of the Movement Defense Committee and with the Law Union, and have done some work around organizing legal observation, or helping other communities start up legal observation or legal support for movements for protest. Oh, and I took a pause from my practice in about 2014 to go back to school to study indigenous legal traditions, because at the time, most of my clients were people in Treaty 9 and Treaty 5 and a little bit of Treaty 3 who frequently spoke to me about wanting to return to their own law. And I felt like that was something that I hadn't received in law school. as many of us didn't at that time anyways. And so I decided to take some time off. And so I also have a master's focusing on indigenous legal orders from UVic. That's me.
All right. My name is Swati. I'm coming to you today from unceded Algonquin territory here, home of the Anishinaabeg people in Ottawa. Your baby is so cute, Megan. I really love seeing them on screen. Yeah, and it was also just really nice listening to you, hearing your journey, because I was called to the bar in about in 2013. I graduated law school in 2012. I took a year off to really just take my time and figure out what I wanted to do, where I wanted to article. I ended up articling at the Law Society of Ontario, and it really is a job that wasn't at all relevant to my, or directly related to the field which I'm currently in, which is immigration and refugee law. I always knew I wanted to do, actually when I was in law school, I learned I wanted to do immigration and refugee law. And so yeah, I did my articles, had a good experience. And then I basically started my own practice right away. I, you know, was connected with already in a lot of movements, doing a lot of migrant justice work and anti-prison work and prison abolition work, border abolition work for a long time through high school and undergrad and law school. And then once I graduated, I had all these already connections with other lawyers who were also like-minded. And somebody, a friend of mine who had a firm, she was like, do you want to come and take some files? So I started taking files. And I was also working at the same time, part-time at the Ontario Justice Education Network. And I was doing like theater-based legal education for youth around Ontario, undocumented youth or precarious status youth, which is awesome. But I couldn't do both jobs. I was offered a full-time position at OGEN. And I just felt like, you know what, I want to try this practice thing. Some people come out of law school and they're like, I don't really want to practice. I just really wanted to kind of get in there and see what it was about. And so that's what I've been doing since then. So I started my practice in about 2013, and here we are. I do solely refugee and immigration law. I work a lot with queer communities. I'm queer, and so that's a big focus for me, like working with queer and trans refugee claimants and other folks in that community. I work with a lot of folks in detention, and I represented the End Immigration Detention Network in a constitutional challenge about the immigration and detention regime here in Canada at the Supreme Court. I was there with them, and also the federal court and the Federal Court of Appeal. And so got really embedded in some of these anti-detention movements, which I'm still working on. And so I'm just like slogging through my own practice every day. Like some days it's easier than others. I just, you know, I'm here, but I do feel, you know, I sometimes feel energized by my work, but I think as we'll talk about in this session, it can also just be like really draining, really exhausting. And it's so, so critical if you're going to do movement lawyering that you have the right supports in place, both within yourself and your own sort of well-being, and then also, you know, your social networks and professionally as well. And I like recently started diversifying with a little bit of teaching, and it's been really fun. And I'm looking forward, it's nice to do a little bit of less client side work and also think about ways in which we can communicate to legal professionals about like how to do this differently and not to just think within the framework that we're taught in law school. So it's been a nice exercise for me to sort of take that side of things at this stage in my career. But so exciting to be like, oh yeah, maybe I could go back to school and like study something that I'm really interested in. And it's really nice to hear about all the options that are still available, which I try to tell law students as well. Like, don't think that what you do, you know, in law school is going to determine your career, or even what you do for your first 10 years is going to determine your career. We've got a lot of privilege and flexibility within this profession to really do things that are meaningful and important to you. So yeah, that's a bit about me.
Hi everyone, I am from Treaty 6 territory, which is Northern Alberta, or portion of Northern Alberta. I'm from Edmonton, which is the home and traditional gathering place or current gathering place for numerous kind of First Nations and Métis communities, including the Cree, Salto, Blackfoot, and a variety of others. I am like super happy to be here and to share, I think, an honest kind of conversation about this life that if you choose to engage in movement lawyering and what that consists of. And, you know, I think what may be a theme for the other speakers is just dealing with challenges, failures, limitations, and just trying to make the most of it. Before I went to law school, I was very active in like university and community organizing around the downstream effects of oil sands development on Indigenous communities in the Athabasca region. So, you know, Fort McMurray, Fort Chipewyan, those areas. And it's what led me to law school. And when I showed up at law school, it dawned on me quite quickly that these big and important questions of justice about how our society responds to these major questions of injustice, how law school doesn't really put you in a position, I think, to address those issues, to figure out what you can do as a participant in our society to help or to kind of support folks. And I felt pretty jaded and unhappy. And I felt as if I was being streamed towards a particular career path that did not reflect why I decided to go down this path to become a lawyer. I summered at this kind of litigation boutique in Calgary that was, you know, if you want to be a successful and good lawyer in the traditional sense, this is a place to end up. They've got great clients, they make a lot of money, with the exception of the fact that they represent the Alberta government in a lot of cases. And the Alberta government is why, like, a big form of my identity and why I hate the state and why I went to law school. So I said, you know, I kind of went back to third year and was really committed to a social justice job or finding something in that realm. And I ended up getting a volunteer article with the Indigenous Community Legal Clinic in the downtown east side of Vancouver. This is the work I really wanted to do. I moved there, and you know, when I was a law student who was super eager, kind of committed to this work, really excited, you know, I remember moving to Vancouver, and I was, you know, like most law students, kind of six-figure debt, no idea how I was going to make it work, but I was going to like start serving on the side, do whatever I need to do to work, get my law degree, work in this area, and you know, have at least a meal a day. 6 weeks into my articles, our supervising lawyer got let go. And that meant that my articles were on hold and kind of, it would be, there was no guarantee that they would hire a supervising lawyer who'd be able to supervise me. So I was in this limbo and it was very terrible, but out of that came an opportunity where I ended up getting a job at a small family law firm in Edmonton. And it was a sink or swim moment, you know, either I kind of commit myself to figuring out how to be a lawyer and then figuring out how to do the work I want to do, or kind of stop and do something else that reflects my values and what I want to do in the world. And I completed those articles, which were terrible, again, made next to nothing. I made like slightly more money than nothing. And at the end of it, I was like, you know, I got a sense of the mechanisms of how to be a lawyer, you know, how to run a law firm. And I just like started my own firm, and I do a variety of kind of public law matters. I do some refugee and immigration law. I do a lot of kind of civil torts against the state for a variety of like police misconduct to prison stuff to like constitutional challenges on various types of policy affecting the rights of former children in care. Substance users. I do some Aboriginal law, and I do a lot more cases on behalf of survivors of sexual violence against the perpetrators, and whatever will come in the door also to pay the bills. So there's this balance that I run between, and it's been a very interesting and challenging experience to date. But yeah, that's who I am.
Wonderful. Thank you all so much. So we'll get to our questions. We have two questions for you, and we'll start with the first one, which is, how do you reconcile your obligations to the legal profession with your engagement in social movements? What are some concrete or practical ways that you have found to advance these causes in your work? And we'll start with you, Swathi.
Yeah, well, I was reflecting on this question a little bit, and I was trying to even tease out what my obligations are to the legal profession. Because, I mean, my obligations are to my clients and to, you know, the work that I'm doing and the outcome I'm trying to achieve. I think that, like, in terms of my obligations to the legal profession, I mean, like, I'm required to follow the law, right? And apply it. I'm required to be polite and maintain decorum, which, no lie, I struggle with that because I'm dealing with things that are life or death. And I find it really hard to sort of be really amicable with the Department of Justice who's trying to deport, you know, a pregnant lady who has mental health issues. Like, it's difficult to sort of have this tempered tone that sort of mutes everything and translates it through the framework of Canadian values. I don't really think, I actually don't think I really have any obligations to the legal profession whatsoever beyond that, beyond like decorum, paying my law society fees, and like, you know, applying the law in a way that's like allowed, permitted by my profession. I think what I struggle to reconcile often is my complicity within an extremely violent system. As a lawyer who is, practicing this immigration and refugee law, which, like many other of our laws in Canada, is premised on the idea of exclusion, racism, colonialism, and keeping Black and brown bodies out of this country, it feels really gross, to be honest, to be arguing within that framework, to kind of have to tailor the situations of my clients to make them seem, you know, really destitute and really desperate and really like just, you know, wanting to be in Canada because Canada's the best place in the world, which to me is, frankly, it's bullshit. It's not true, right? Like, that's not why people come here. That's not what people's experiences are. And yet, if I want to get an outcome from my client, I have to operate within this system where I'm just sort of, you know, reframing what they're saying and translating in a way that like majority white people will understand, white Western people. And so that for me has been like, I would say, the biggest struggle in terms of feeling this real conflict within myself, where I'm spending all this time and I'm trying to get this outcome for my client, but really in the process, I'm perpetuating what I see to be a very violent system. I see it impacting my clients every day. And it also impacts me as someone with migration experience, as someone who's queer and trans, as someone who loves people who are in jail or in prison or in detention. That is really, really hard. But I think that when I think about my goals within my practice and my social movements, the social movements that I'm a part of, I'm pretty blessed in the sense that I have really put my energy towards things that are really compatible with the goals of the social movements that I'm involved in. And so I don't really do anything in my practice that I feel would be fundamentally in conflict or incompatible with the social movements that I'm a part of. And so I try really hard to be engaged with the actual goals of my clients. And even if sometimes that conflicts with what I would consider to be the right legal strategy. So, for example, I represented the End Immigration Detention Network, which is an organization that started in 2013 when 191 migrant detainees went on strike at the Central East Correctional Center, a maximum security facility where they were detained. Largest migrant strike in Canadian history. Out of this grew a large campaign to effectively end immigration detention. But one of the big asks of this, of my client, because we went into litigation and we became a public interest party to a constitutional challenge, and we came in, got lots of evidence, put forward this sort of this public interest argument. And one of the conflicts was, you know, my clients are saying, okay, so we were asking for, right now in Canada, immigration detainees can be held indefinitely. Okay, so there's no maximum time limit for which someone can be held in an immigration detention center or a provincial jail on an immigration hold. And so we were challenging the lawfulness of that, and we were requesting a presumptive period to be put in place. So a maximum time period after which point someone in this administrative non-punitive detention had to be released. Now, my clients were asking me for 3 months, saying that after 3 months, all immigration detainees had to be released. That was the ask of the campaign. I knew from a legal standpoint, there was no way in hell that was going to fly. At least they had to say 6 months, but there's no court who was going to hear that. And sure enough, when I went forward with this ask, the judges at the Federal Court of Appeal were very incredulous. Like, they just were like, are you actually, is this what you're saying? Because this is not supported by the law, and this is, you know, much too short of a time, et cetera. And I was like, yep, this is what I, you know, have been asked to do and instructed to do by my clients. And like, my clients are people in immigration detention. These are their lived experiences. That's my job. My job isn't necessarily to get that win, but it's to voice their demands to the court. So I just try to always be guided by the social movements that I'm working with, rather than what the law is effectively dictating.
You know, I think that what Swathi raises is very important. And I think I just want to reorient the conversation a bit. I don't see a necessary inherent conflict between our participation in these social movements with our duty as a lawyer, because as Swathi mentioned, like, our duty is to represent our clients' interests and be fearless in that. I think, like, personally, what I've seen as being an issue and something that I've tried to work out is where our ability as advocates and lawyers to some extent, in some cases, depends on a court or another party taking our words and taking our position on a file serious enough to fully consider it. And that is, I think, where the tension I've experienced comes from, where, you know, how hard to push on a particular issue where you don't lose a court, or, you know, when a court hears your name, like on the docket, they don't have, they don't have presuppositions about who you are and what you're going to say and whether they're going to believe you or not. And there is this tension that I've faced working in this realm repeatedly, is what positions do I take? What arguments do I make? How much do I engage in the media? How specific am I in terms of calling out a state actors or even the court if they don't do something that I want them to do or I think is kind of fair and just in the circumstances? And, you know, does that compromise my position to the movement? Because in a particular movement, in the work I do, particularly with substance users, I did this case around marginalized, racialized people in a housing kind of project and who are being evicted. And in both cases, like it kind of boiled down to what degree do I voice concerns in a way that would alienate me with the court? Because if in those circumstances, if their lawyer is not being treated, if I'm not being accepted by the court or considered to be a reasonable advocate, or not reasonable, that's not the right word, but someone the court should pay attention to and hear my voice, then I am of no value to my clients. So there's this tension that I continually have to deal with. And even in that case with the housing issue, my clients are being evicted. We're talking about, 60 to 70 families, racialized, impoverished folks. This was during March to June of 2020, so COVID. And, I have single mothers with four kids coming to me and asking me, what shelter is going to accommodate me because I have to leave this place in like a week. And we brought an injunction application. We lost the injunction application. And the housing provider was a charity, a well-known charity all over the world. And it happens to be the charity that the judiciary in Alberta, but particularly Edmonton, is the primary donor of. Like, they have walks and fundraising campaigns. Every year there's a list of top donors and the names of our judiciary are on that list. And before we had the injunction hearing, I wrote to the court. I'm like, no justice who's affiliated with this or has been a past donor should hear this case. I think it's important. My clients want to ensure that happens from the perspective of fairness. And my clients come from countries where, the judiciary, where the certain standards of judicial independence are not as pervasive as here, at least that's what we claim to say. And in this case, I argued the injunction hearing over a couple of days, very trying, very emotional for my clients. Week later, we get the decision, we lose. So all 50 or 60 families have a week or so to figure out where they're gonna move. And then it becomes known that the judge who heard the case is actually a donor, a consistent donor to this charity. And at that moment, I know what I had to do, right? Like, we have this very dire situation for my clients, and I was going to make as much noise as possible to kind of push this charity, but to hopefully cause a public conversation over what's happening. You know, that notion that, you know, sunlight is the best disinfectant, and especially when like people in the average community are like, why is a judge hearing this case, kicking out all these people in the circumstances? And I got a call from a lot of senior lawyers, well-positioned lawyers within our legal system and profession in Alberta, people who kind of warned me to kind of measure or restrain myself in terms of the criticism I was making, because it, you know, was not fair. Who cares if this person was a donor, and that it would harm my career or my prospects or my ability to be taken seriously by the judiciary if I engaged in what they consider to be not like personal attacks, but raising real questions about bias. And, you know, it was one of those moments that, like Swathi was saying, like, if I'm going to shut up now, why am I a lawyer? Like, why am I down this path? Because I am the advocate for these folks, for these people who are relying upon me. Like, it's one thing to be a supporter of their cause and whatever, but if these folks have hired me as their lawyer, they're advocating the legal realm in these institutions, I can't be afraid of the personal ramifications or the professional ramifications of me doing my job. And end of the day, our duty to the profession and to the cause of justice and in these flawed institutions that we serve or participate in is to speak truth on behalf of our clients, ensure that their voice is heard. And, you know, in, as a result of that, that like our clients will get what they want, but the broader cause of justice will like prevail or be advanced. So it's very challenging, and it comes up again and again and again and again. I think if you're in this realm, and it's really kind of difficult to navigate this, I think personally. Because sometimes it's not as stark as the example I provided. And yeah, that's all I wanted to say on that.
Gosh, I feel like for me personally, I'm just constantly in a state of conflict. It is very personal in that my husband, my children, my relatives are all Indigenous and I'm a settler. And I'm working in the settler legal system, even while those that are close to me are desperately trying to revitalize and work on projects of Indigenous law. And so I just feel like I'm constantly in this place of entrenching a system and seeking out its tools and doing what I can with it, even while literally in the next room, my husband is trying to develop the legal theory underlying international law. It's a metaphor that I've heard a number of different people give to me. The best way that I can sort of protect my own self while like living in this state of conflict without just going bananas, bouncing between places, is that Indigenous people's lives, and this will be true of your practices as well, lives are at stake. And so while others are doing that work of coming up with imaginative possibility and revitalizing legal theory and unearthing all of that law that always was there and always will remain, I'm trying to hold the door shut while the state comes after those people. So I use the state's law and I try to hold the door shut, and all the people on the inside get to do the cool work that my mind frankly isn't suited for. I don't have that skill. I'm no theorist. I have such a Western viewpoint that sometimes I can glimpse the problems in my own thought processes or the things, the unconscious assumptions, but truly I can't really get beyond all of those assumptions. I can tell you about 100 stories of when I tried to learn some aspect of Indigenous law and got a very direct answer and then thought of it as a non sequitur because it was so far from my expectation. So that's how I reconcile this sort of constant conflict, to say that, you know, somebody has to hold the door shut. The state is coming after these people with termination policy. And so I'll hold the door shut while others do that good work of imagining a new system and a new future for the rest of us. It's sort of a constant negotiation to say, what's the best way for me to use this toolbox that I have on behalf of you whose cause I believe in, but right now everything is a colonial mess. And so you just got to exist in this really messy business and do the best you can. That's a terrible answer, I think. Just being messy, live in the conflict.
No, it's quite helpful because I often have these reflections with pals in Radlaw and other spaces like that. We long for a clean and clear path for how can I exist here. So it's very helpful to keep in mind that it is chaotic and it is messy, but we can still contribute and do good work within that. The second question that we have for the panel is, what is something that you wish you had known while you were in law school in terms of skills that we as law students will need as lawyers who want to work within social movements, but that we will not be taught in law school?
What we mean by that is, you know, for example, Swathi, of course, you talked about a little bit of like the burnout and having good people in your circle, or Avi, you talked about, you know, that level of making a noise, right, and attracting attention strategically. It can be more like practical things. We're talking about strategy and, you know, the space for working within the system, space for working outside a system. So Swathi, do you wanna kick us off with?
Yeah. Oh man, law school is such a load of bullshit. Like, it just straight up is, at least when I was in law school, and I don't think that it's changed that much from what I hear from the law students that I'm currently with, working with. And yeah, I mean, like, I think there's a few things. I think that first and foremost, what I wish that I had been taught in law school, or I wish like there was a perspective that presented this, was just that, you know, because even with people who've been like really engaged in social movements, they go to law school and then somehow come out of law school with this dilution of that social movement mentality and this idea that, you know, as a lawyer, you have this specific kind of prominent, important role to play within movements, and it's your role to kind of go in and apply the law. And there's this very mentality that the law is supreme, the supremacy of the law, and this sort of almost worship of the law. I feel that I see in a lot of legal professionals who come out of law school, even ones who are quote unquote social justice minded. So I think really understanding for me and unlearning all of that took a lot of time, because I didn't even know what a lawyer was when I went to law school. Legit, I had never even met a lawyer. I don't have them in my family. That was just nothing I was ever exposed to. I was like, what is this thing? Because like until I was in a clinic, I didn't understand what even was, how law worked. Like, how could it be, how does it apply? Because it just seems so abstract. And so I think just really having the opportunity to unlearn that mentality that the law is supreme, that like I as a lawyer have this specific positionality within a movement, because I think going into movements feels, if I'm doing movement lawyering work, genuinely speaking, and the advice that I would have for folks who are trying to do this is to actually go in to movements as a non-lawyer, wearing a non-lawyer hat, doing non-lawyer roles, and even just determining whether or not legal help is needed. And if not, do something else. Because I think first and foremost, it's about being connected with movements and not just doing it within your lawyer scope. So I try in my practice, I have my legal practice, and then I have all the stuff I do outside my legal practice, which is sometimes I end up wearing the hat of a lawyer because people turn to me for that advice and information. But then oftentimes I'm just doing things that are totally unrelated to my legal profession, which is really nourishing and helps me as a practitioner in my approach when I am positioned as a lawyer to understand all the other aspects of movement and where I fall within that, which is often just a more public piece than other people, but not in any way more valuable. And this idea, I think, in law school that everything is very siloed, like you're in these sort of like either in a firm environment or in your own practice environment, and it's like this very disconnected sort of separate thing from movements or even other lawyers or other fields. And so I wish there had been more of an emphasis on the fact that there's so many ways in which legal professionals can connect with each other, can connect with other movements, can be part of those things. It doesn't have to be this sort of separate mentality, which I think is something that capitalism also really engenders within us as part of this profession. And so what I really wish, and I'm seeing it a little bit more in law school now, is the emphasis on, or at least paying some attention to, the deep emotional impact of this work, and how incredibly painful it is, how much burnout is so real, how if you don't put in place those self-care strategies from the beginning, you will burn out. I burnt out. I really burnt out, and everybody suffered, including my clients. And so I really would appreciate having more openness around that conversation, the mental health of lawyers, the addiction issues of lawyers, the pressures that we face, in that sense, to really bring that to the fore and make sure that we can support ourselves and each other in this work.
I'm sure that we would love to hear also kind of strategies. I mean, I know strategies are personal, but maybe things to keep in mind going in, because I think it's also easy to kind of think, oh, that won't happen to me, or I'll know when I'm burning out. But especially when you're working with communities that you care so much about, or causes you care so much about, it might be difficult to kind of really be strict with yourself and put those self-care practices in place. If you want to expand on that.
Yeah, I'll just add to that a little bit. I think you're right that it's totally personal, but you do have to, I think it starts with building that self-awareness and developing that self-awareness. So for me, I know when I'm out of character. So like when I have, when I don't give a shit about one of my clients who's coming in and telling me like a really intense story about sexual violence, and I'm just sitting there being like, can you move on? I know something is wrong. I know that I am not rested. I know that I am at capacity. I know I'm not at my best. And so now I've learned to take a step back and like put in place really firm boundaries, which, as you say, Camilla, I think is a really important point. It's so easy in this field to be like, because everyone's needs are so pressing and intense, and you compare them to your own needs and you're like, well, what's a night of sleep versus like this person who might be deported? But it actually matters. So learning to prioritize yourself. I started to set really strict boundaries after my burnout. Like I have two phones. So I have a work phone, and I literally like hide it in my apartment after work hours, which has worked against me because I haven't found it after a couple of days. That's happened to me in my, like, deep within my couch cushions. But I have work-life separation. I stop work at a certain time. I do not work on the weekends. I try to give myself the weekends unless I really can't avoid it. I try to designate time to bill, because if I'm not getting paid, then, you know, it feels really, really shitty to be working 60-hour weeks, 70-hour weeks, and like still borrowing money from my sister to pay my rent, which has happened, and more recently than I'd like to admit. And so, yeah, like really putting that in place. And then also what I would say to y'all is like, just hang out with non-lawyers. So people who are not lawyers, people who don't do law, who don't practice law, who don't care about law, who see it for what it is, which is like typically a tool of repression. And I just feel like that is super nourishing. And I really feel nourished also by doing things that are movement focused, which are outside of my legal practice. So I actually really feel nourished about going into organizing spaces where I'm not positioned as a lawyer, because I'm finally able to work outside the system in ways and like think about a diversity of tactics that I can't do when I'm within the legal field. So I super encourage you to find that that space of nourishment outside of your practice, which often won't come from directly from the practice.
Sure. Like I'm like Swathi to some extent, where when I came to law, it was something, or law school was very different from like the communities and spaces that I existed within before. And there was this real sense, at least it was beaten into me when I was there, that like there's this cookie cutter model of what you need to be to become a lawyer, and a good one. And, you know, I think it's very natural to try to fit in this space, like really try to figure out what the secret is, or kind of reorient yourself in order to fit this kind of stereotype or archetype of what it means to be a lawyer. And then when I got out of law school and into practice, I realized that like that cultural and social knowledge that I had before was so valuable, so critical to, you know, figuring out like, or understanding my clients, where they're coming from, what they want, but also how to use the system to get them what they want. So there is this habit to, I think, particularly folks who don't come from a law background, racialized folks, to kind of abandon or ignore aspects of who you are, your identity, your experiences, in favor of what you learn in that legal environment, kind of the social status and cultural spaces you access in law school or as a lawyer. And I have come to realize that that is not good. It's not authentic, but I think that if you work in these spaces as a community lawyer in movement organizing, that it is frankly, it's to your detriment. Another thing I wanted to touch upon is that what Swathi mentioned, and I think Megan mentioned also, is that when you're in these spaces, you're not the protagonist. The lawyers are not the protagonists. The lawyers are part of a movement, part of a team to achieve a particular outcome. And it's very rare where the court or the judicial process that you're engaging is going to give you the outcome that you need to really achieve what the movement needs or to advance this particular cause. So sometimes we're taught in law that that it is the lawyer, it's all on the lawyer's shoulders, it's through their written arguments, it's through that Supreme Court of Canada decision where real justice or advances are made in a particular realm. But it's part of a diversity of tactics, it's part of a broader movement. And you need to accept the fact, that some of the cases we bring in this space, particularly impact litigation, like test case litigation, you know, you're going to lose. And sometimes those losses are going to be significant. I've done a lot of cases over the last few years in Alberta around substance use policy, right? And for those folks who don't know, I'm sure Quebec is the same as Alberta and British Columbia, where so many people are dying, right? So many people dying of preventable deaths associated with substance use, usually opioid poisoning. And in Alberta in 2019, we elected a government who does not care, puts in place measures that are, you know, facilitate the death of people, right? And in Alberta, the deaths, you know, overwhelmingly Indigenous, overwhelmingly folks who are obviously impoverished, who face a lot of structural and societal barriers. The most marginalized and vulnerable people are dying at rates that, you know, right now in Alberta, about 5 people a day. All preventable deaths, all result of policy decisions of this government. And one of the cases I did, the first case, it was, so there's various ways to kind of treat or allow people who use substances to continue to survive, you know, and methadone is a commonly known kind of treatment program. Another one that is prevalent in British Columbia and Alberta, I'm not sure, I don't think it's in Quebec, or it might be, I don't think it's in Ontario, although it's coming. It's called injectable opioid agonist treatment, which basically means you provide folks who use substances, particularly opioids, who don't respond to lesser interventions methods, like methadone doesn't give anything to them. It doesn't give them the experience that they want. So they'll go and use street source opioids, which is a high risk of killing people. So, you know, a doctor will prescribe pharmaceutical grade heroin or morphine. So it is like, it's potent. It gives them what they need to satisfy the cravings. It also is, you know, regulated in the sense that you're not consuming something that may kill you and you don't know until you try it. And there's wraparound support. Someone can get, you know, healthcare services incidental to their substance use. And it's a safe way. People don't die. It's a really great program. And it's for the most vulnerable marginalized substance users, people who, you know, overdose multiple times, you know, in a month, people who it's they're likely going to die if they don't get on this program. And Alberta had the best program in the country. It was saving people. It was monumental. This government comes in and says, we're cutting it. And the consequence of that would be, you know, the 100 people in this program, they would likely to die and die quickly because of their substance use and because of the potency of substances in Alberta at the time. And so, you know, we sue on various charter grounds. We bring, again, an injunction application. And you got to understand also that, like, as a movement lawyer, as someone in this space, particularly in Alberta, like in other centers, when they're doing this type of work, there's a bit of a disconnect between a lawyer and the person who's directly harmed, because there's like civil society actors, various like groups who represent the interests of substance users, such as civil liberties organizations, other health organizations. But in Alberta, we don't have that infrastructure. So in this case, like, I was hired by substance users in this program, and I would go to where substance users are located in Edmonton and Calgary, in their spaces, spending like lots of time to understand their experiences, their aspirations, what this treatment program provided them. And I took their stories and I put it part of a record. You know, I had affidavits from folks talking about how, like, if you are a woman or someone who identifies as a woman in these spaces and you rely upon street source opioids, the likelihood of sexual violence, it's a certainty. Like exploitation, experiences that are devastating day in, day out. This program stopped that. This program not only allowed a lot of these women to no longer experience that harm, but also get their children back, right? They have stability in their lives. Some of them kind of return to work, were in their own housing, transformative, right? And then you go and sit down with these folks and you listen to what they fear most about being cut off from this program and going back to that life, right? And it's hard for me to convey just the fear in their eyes, you know, the real sense that like death was a better outcome than living that life. And, you know, you take the stories, you put an affidavit, appear in front of a judge, you make the argument. And in that particular case, we lost the injunction, right? We lost the injunction on the incorrect identification of the test at the second branch of irreparable harm, right? And, you know, it got really messed up when we lost, right? I got really messed up because this is not abstract. This is not like a fact pattern. This is people I talk to on the phone, who text me all the time, who like, you know, we have a relationship that is beyond this legal case that I'm doing, you know what I mean? And then most recently, Camilla and I were working on a case out in Alberta where they want to restrict access to supervised consumption sites, right? Again, people will die as a result of this measure. Keep that other case in mind too. But in this case, we brought this application, we brought an injunction to stop the changes from going in that will, like all the experts agree, will deter access to supervised consumption sites, will kill people. And we go to a judge to have this heard. Judge is like, yeah, this may be unconstitutional. Yes, it will cause people to die, but the balance of convenience favors not stopping the measure until we can decide if it's constitutional. So basically the court's like, people will die, but we're going to just accept that in the circumstance for reasons. And again, people I talk to day in, day out, kind of a devastating, devastating experience. And what I've come to realize is that you have to learn how to grieve, like you got to figure out how to continue to exist and kind of occupy these spaces and serve in the way that you've been asked to serve by your clients, and kind of come back from these losses in a way that doesn't destroy you. Because, like, you know, like, particularly in that IOT case, the first case I talked to you about, I was just like rocked, right? Just rocked because of those personal relationships you had experienced. But in IOT, what was reaffirmed within me was that you're part of a movement, that you're part of a movement. And, you know, it doesn't end with you. And in that case, so we lost the injunction. And, you know, as soon as we lost, we started making a lot of noise, right? This was a very high profile case within Alberta media here, within kind of the political scene. And, you know, we kept kind of going, and I made a big deal with the help of my clients and kind of activists in the space about how the judge made like a blatant mistake, like that it's like he quoted the wrong line of the test, said it's the wrong threshold, and brought like this emergency injunction application, emergency appeal to the Court of Appeal. And I remember we filed on the Monday or the Friday, and the next day the Alberta government settled it. So they decided not to cut the program. And I don't know why they made that decision, to be frank with you, because you know, we lost the injunction. They could have done whatever they wanted, but maybe just the notion of the real people that were part of the story, part of that court case that the media had interviewed and like talked about how this individual, you know, was 20 years old and had, you know, extreme trauma in their life, and this program gave them a second chance. And, you know, the idea of that person potentially being harmed or dying, and the political ramifications that wasn't worth it for this government to continue on with, that they would just settle it to kind of end it. Like, I don't know. But end of the day, it got resolved. And I think it got resolved not because of our legal argument, not because of what a court said, but because of, you know, we're part of the movement that was banging on the doors or various doors to get the job done, and it got it done. But the legal stuff was part of the story. You didn't get the outcome, but it's part of the story, and you gotta have to figure out what your role is. And on a personal level, again, like it may be tough to deal with these cases, tough to deal with these losses, but if you wanna do this work, I think you just have to, like Swathi said, figure out how to do this in a sustainable manner, because it can be quite devastating and really tear you apart, but it's worthwhile.
I think, well, I'd echo everything that Swathi and Avnish have just said about self-care, and I don't have very much to add to that, because truly I'm the worst. I've had to have my butt handed to me several times before I could start. I'm neither self-reflective enough to figure out when I'm going off the rails, nor have the tools put in place. And I had very funny ideas about self-care. I always thought you could sort of take on really painful work, and then I'm going to use a flippant example, I don't truly mean it, but like take a hot bath and you self-care yourself back to healthy, and then you could take on the work. And I had to be told that like it's not like you drop from the bank, you come back up, you drop from the bank. Like eventually you run out of the energy for this, and like you were just saying, is take a long picture, think about yourself in this, and the long haul is part of a movement, and figure out how much energy you have over the long haul, because self-care keeps you going, but it does not fix the amount of pain that you take on. It doesn't do that. But in terms of what I wish I knew in law school, I felt like I went to law school at the University of Manitoba, which is a very focused on doctrine and not very focused on theory or other things. And so I felt like I came from behind a little bit, honestly, because when I started in Toronto, most of my friends were from Osgoode and U of T, and it seemed like they had entire degrees of feminist legal theory and like had taken all these cool courses and already understood law and within the structures. And I've always been amazed with my students here at McGill. Not only are there so many of you, like I had two friends, there are so many of you that you have like a big group of people to talk about. So I, for me, it may not be relevant anymore, but relationships were the most important thing to me. And so I kind of wish somebody had told me like, forget how law school feels, and forget what people have told you about being a lawyer. Just find those like-minded people, and those will be how you start to negotiate this world that you want to be in, or the world that you'd like to create. What is the law? What is the law? What is the law?
What is the law? What is the law? You've been listening to Legalese on CKUT 90.3 FM. And you just heard part one of the Movement Lawyering Together panel. That was Megan Daniel, currently a professor at McGill University Faculty of Law and a practitioner working out of Ontario. Avnish Nanda, a public interest lawyer out of Alberta and BC, as well as Swathi Sakar, a lawyer specializing in immigration and refugee law working out of Ontario. That is all from us today. Stay tuned for part two of this series, which will be coming out next month, and it will be the French portion of the event, where you'll get the chance to hear from the four other incredible radical lawyers. Thank you again for listening, and thank you to every person who contributed to the show. A special thank you as well to the speakers for doing this panel with us, for their work in the community, as well as to everyone who attended the event back in March. You can listen to Legalese every second Friday of the month from 11 a.m. to noon Eastern Time on CKUT 90.3 FM. If you have any ideas of topics you'd like us to cover, legal or not, you can write to us at legalese@ckut.ca. You can find our episodes on Spotify, as well as follow up with us on Facebook at Legalese CKUT.
Black Rose Books invites you to our book launch event.
Confronting Canada's Past and Europe's Forgotten Revolutions.
Happening on Sunday, May 22nd, featuring the authors and editors of
Stand on Guard for Whom?
The Fire That Time.
Insatiable Hunger.
The Forgotten Revolution.
And Black Ukraine Yesterday and Today.
Join us on live stream or in person at 2 p.m.
at the Cité des Hospitalières, 251 Pine West, Corner Park.
Free tickets are available at blackroselaunch.eventbrite.ca or visit blackrosebooks.com for more information.
This event is co-presented with the Cité des Hospitaliers en Transition and CKUT-FM.
Good afternoon, you're tuned to Butcher T's Noontime Cuts, hitting every Friday from noon to 2, playing your wide variety of music just to make your afternoon delight just right. So stay locked into CKT 90.3 FM.